It's time to turn to the WUKY Sports page with your host, Keith Elkins, revealing conversations and stories you thought you knew from prominent Kentucky sports figures. Now, here once again is Keith Elkins.
David Sullivan is with us today, longtime sports broadcaster who was with ESPN in the early days of that network, also served as sports director with WDRB-TV in Louisville, WXIA-TV in Atlanta, WPXI in Pittsburgh, WAVY-TV in Norfolk. He's a former Wildcat football player, and he got his start in broadcasting by helping his father, Claude Sullivan, the former voice of the Kentucky Wildcats and the Cincinnati Reds. David, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Keith, thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you. I am living in Naples, Florida right now, but we hope to move back to Lexington. I miss the bluegrass a lot.
Well, I was going to ask you about your current situation. Now, you've been down in Florida for a little while, I guess. Catch us up on what's going on there.
Well, I retired and have just been relaxing down here and enjoying the sun and the surf type of thing. But every now and then I do get itchy feet to get back into something. So I don't think I'll ever be really retired.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the nice thing about the broadcasting business is that sometimes you can find a good opportunity without the full-time commitment and all the travel that's involved and still contribute. And I can understand you wanting to do that.
Yeah.
In the book about Claude Sullivan, your father, the former voice of the Wildcats, the book is titled Voice of the Wildcats, Claude Sullivan and the Rise of Modern Sports Broadcasting, written by your brother Alan Sullivan and Joe Cox. Alan mentions you frequently in there and talked about your start in broadcasting, helping your dad on some of the UK broadcasts. How old were you when you started doing that, and what did he have you doing?
You know, Keith, I'll tell you a funny anecdote that I don't know that anybody has ever mentioned, but I was 13 years old, and my dad came home from the radio station one day and said, the Lexington Pee Wee All-Star football team is going to play the Ohio All-Star Pee Wee team, and the station thinks it'd be a good idea if a kid did the broadcast. So you're going to do the game.
Wow.
I said, Dad, I don't know how to do that. He said, don't worry, I'm going to be right with you. I'm going to be your spotter. And my voice hadn't changed. It was still crackling. I had a tape of that somewhere. It's kind of hilarious. But that was the first thing I ever did. And then Dad believed in giving both Alan and I responsibilities at a young age. And he got me involved and my brother. And I did the engineering on all the UK games, starting when I was about, I guess I was 15, 14 or 15. And I did that right through 1967. So It was a great experience. I'll tell you, I was riding the level on his microphone. That was my job, to make sure he didn't overmodulate and distort. And I'd be watching the game and listening to him, and he would give me an elbow in the side, like point to that thing and say, David, without saying a word. The look he gave me was like, get on the ball here.
Yeah.
But it was a great experience, and it really taught me a lot. In 1966, when Kentucky went to College Park, Maryland, played in the Final Four in the championship game. My father was doing a Cincinnati Reds game, spring training, and he flew back and forth from Tampa up to College Park from the semifinal game with Duke. And so I was up there by myself, and my job was to make sure all of the equipment was set up properly, and we did the Adolph Rupp interview as the post game. And because you were up in a skybox where the broadcast was done, Adolph couldn't go up all those steps. So I had to put a microphone and run lines and so forth down onto the floor level. And so here I am, 16, 17 years old, 18, dealing with union guys from the phone company.
Mm-hmm.
And they put the phone, put the line in the wrong place and things like that. So I had a lot of experiences. It taught me a lot. And I wouldn't give anything for those years.
You know, I was going to ask you about that that game and being there on duty at the time. It was, of course, in 1966. Kentucky was the national runner-up in basketball, the famous Rupp's Runts team, which didn't have a starter over 6'5", went to the championship game when they were upset by Texas Western. And of course, as you mentioned, you were right there. There are many, many things that make that game memorable. It's become more memorable over the years and more recounted in various ways. And you were the assistant on the radio broadcast, and as you mentioned, had some challenges to deal with yourself. Anything else that you take from that game in terms of the social significance? I know you were very young at the time, but anything else that stands out to you about that game, which has, taken on more significance as the years have gone by?
Yeah, and at my age at that time, I don't think those kinds of issues were on my brain. I don't think I totally knew what was going on in that regard. Later, I go to be a freshman at UK football, and I play with the first African-Americans to play in the Southeastern Conference, Greg Page and Matt Northington.
Yeah.
And then, you know, it all became probably much more clear to me as I saw what my teammates had to endure.
And you were part of UK athletics at a very, very memorable time between the Runts and the integration of the football program. But even going back before the mid '60s, you had some access to UK, of course, that most young fans would not have. Tell me about what that was like, visiting practices, maybe getting to know the coaches and players at a time when you were maybe 10, 11, 12 years old, a time when it would really make an impression on a young fan.
Oh, it was unbelievable because the basketball coaches, Adolph Rupp, Perry Lancaster, you know, I knew them, they knew me. I was a kid, but I was around that. I did go to practice with my dad and got to sit up there, and nobody talked during an Adolph Rupp practice. Mm-hmm. Nobody. There's not a word spoken in the gym except Adolph. So it was a rule that I learned early on. But yeah, it was an interesting way of growing up. I was very fortunate and very lucky to be exposed to the types of things that I was at a very young age that very, very few young people have that opportunity. So I'm very appreciative of it and treasure all those moments.
Well, of course, your dad became one of the voices of the Cincinnati Reds in 1964, so now you're adding baseball to the family's schedule. I know you made a lot of visits to Crosley Field and then a little bit later other National League parks as well. I went to some games at Crosley in the early to mid-60s, and what a wonderful place to watch a ball game, and I guess it gets better as the memories get older, but it was such a great ballpark, and I remember access to the players and things like that. Now, again, your access was exceptional, but what do you recall about the years at Crosley Field?
Well, I loved Crosley Field. I mean, it was just the epitome to me of what a baseball park should be. And the terrace in the outfield had unique features to it. It wasn't a cookie-cutter stadium like came along in the 70s. It had a lot of personality, and I just, the smell of the park, the smell of popcorn and peanuts and hot dogs and all that. And at that age, it was just, I loved every minute of it. And I was so fortunate that we would go up with our dad. He commuted from Lexington up there to do the game. So he would take us up there quite frequently, and we were down on the field during batting practice, able to stand around and watch the players. The biggest experience and memory I have was, and it may have been in 64, that my father said that he had gotten permission to take my brother and I on a road trip with the Reds to Pittsburgh, Philadelphia, and New York. Now, Pete Rose was on that team, Veda Pinson, Frank Robinson. You know, that was the mid-60s Reds teams. And being around the ball players and watching them and how they behaved and how they kid each other, they were constantly ribbing each other. I think athletes in all levels do that. Mm-hmm. And going to Pittsburgh, to Old Forbes Field, and to Philadelphia, and then Shea Stadium when they played a series up there with the Mets. So I got to see that, and it was quite exciting, I must say.
People remember the fans of a certain age, remember those Reds teams, and there were a lot of great stars on those Reds teams. They had a series team in 61, and while they didn't go back to the series again until 1970, it was certainly some fine baseball played at Crosley Field. Any particular encounters with Rose or Robinson or Pinson or anybody else that fans will remember from Reds history?
No, I really can't recall anything. It was just, I think I was so just enthralled at being with them. It was, I remember on the bus coming back, they always liked to kid the bus driver. Mm-hmm. And they ribbed the bus drivers all the time. And the drivers, they called them bussy. Yeah. And I could just remember those players doing that all the time. And that's something that I thought that was kind of funny. But I saw their personalities that way, away from the media and on the spotlight.
And even though you were very young at the time, I think you can begin to get the appreciation that when baseball people are away from the game, they miss the game. If they have to be away from it, they miss the game. But it seems like most of all, if you talk to guys long enough, they'll tell you they miss that time around the batting cage or the time in the clubhouse or the time on the bus or on the plane. It's the camaraderie that they miss. And you got to see that up close. And that's going on 100% of the time, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Absolutely. And I can tell you, I understand what they're saying, like you just described. Those are relationships that they develop, and as a team, they bond with each other.
We talked briefly about your football playing experience for Kentucky. Take me back through those years. You were there during the Charlie Bradshaw years, and we talked about it being a memorable era, and it was. Coach Bradshaw came in very highly regarded as a former assistant, and there was a lot of optimism for his time at Kentucky, but he was very tough on the players. What are your memories as a football player for playing for him?
Well, tough is an understatement.
Mm-hmm.
Charlie Bradshaw was a very difficult coach to play for, but I respected him as a player, and I would run through a wall for the man, even though he beat me to death some days. It was kind of that kind of relationship. A lot of the players quit. I came in as a freshman in 1966. We had 40 on our freshman team, and when I was a senior, I think we had 10 left.
Wow.
Some, like Greg Page, died from an injury in a practice. But every other player on that freshman team that wasn't there at the end quit. They just couldn't take it anymore. And that's too bad, because when I went there, there was no McDonald's High School All-American team, but Sports Illustrated was rating the freshman teams, and they rated Kentucky's freshman team the best in the country. We had 5 high school All-Americans on the team, which would be like 5-star players today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we played a freshman game against the University of Tennessee, and as I recall, beat them 56-0. Mm. It was a strong group of players, I want to tell you. And I felt I was a linebacker. I was undersized. I was playing around guys bigger and faster than me. So my whole attitude was I was going to prove I belonged there and that I could play with them and that I could contribute. And that was kind of what got me through a lot of the hard, difficult practices and things that we went through. One year we went to Vanderbilt and ended up in a terrible rainstorm, just an ugly game, and we tied 0-0. And we get back to Lexington, and Coach Bradshaw comes on the team bus as we're going from the airport back to the practice facility. He said, y'all didn't play a football game this afternoon, so you're going to play one tonight. And we scrimmaged under the lights until 1 o'clock or so in the morning.
Wow.
Yeah, it was I can't believe they would be getting away with that today.
Well, he was he's now remembered for those things too, and of course the legendary thin 30 from the early 60s as the roster dwindled, and it sounds like that was continuing during your era as well. You could have of course enjoyed and appreciated all those experiences in broadcasting without wanting to become a broadcaster yourself. What made you decide that you wanted to get into broadcasting as a career?
Keith, I actually had no... My dad died when I was 19. Mm-hmm. I was still at UK as a sophomore. I had not made a career decision. He had wanted me to go to law school, and I didn't want to do that, but I was working on a degree in business. That's all I knew. And I always, from a young age, liked to perform. I did play acting in plays. I went to a summer drama for a week at UK when I was in high school. So I knew I was good at speaking. I did public speaking and competitions in high school. But I never had set a definite course that I wanted to be a sportscaster and be like my father. I never had that in my head. After he passed away, and then a couple of years after that, I get a phone call one day. I was finished with my football career from a good friend of mine, Farrell Wellman, who I know you know, Farrell.
Sure.
He's
mm-hmm.
in the Kentucky Sports Journalism Hall of Fame. He said, hey, I'm looking for a weekend radio news host here at DLK Radio. Why don't you try that? I said, I've never even thought of doing anything like that. And he said, I think you might be good at it. So that's what I did, and I ended up getting into the business. And I knew that I really then wanted to do sports. And I went to the general manager of WVOK, Bill Stakelin, and said, is there any way I can do a game here or there? He said, well, David, as long as Ralph Acker's here, no, because he does all the high school games. He was doing some Kentucky stuff. So I couldn't get any sports. And he called me in one day and he said, WCYN in Cynthiana is looking for somebody to do the tournament up there, basketball tournament. And I told him about you. So I did it for $10 a game. And that got my interest up. I knew that's really what I wanted to do. I really loved it. And so then this happened to me a couple of times. I'd have people that I knew come up to me and say, David, we're listening to you on VOK. Boy, you do a great job. But you know what? There'll never be another one like Claude Sullivan.
Yeah.
I said, yeah. No, you're exactly right. There won't be. And he was unique, and I had no intention of trying to be like him. And my dad had told me one time, if I ever went into it, be yourself, mm-hmm. be David, do whatever you can do, but don't try to be like anybody else. He wasn't talking about himself so much, but maybe he was. So I left and went to Norfolk, Virginia, mm-hmm. trying to, you know, pave my way. And I set up, I see Joe Buck, who grew up, you know, with his father being a sportscaster, Tom Brenneman up in Cincinnati. And I admire what they've done because it was tough. It was tough right after your father passed away and was such a legend in Lexington and in Kentucky. And I said, you know, I want to go away and prove to myself if I can do it or not on my own without being compared to him. And that kind of drove me. And I ended up doing sports in Norfolk. And then I went to Atlanta and Pittsburgh, and I had a really good career.
Yes, you did. You certainly did. And I wanted to tell you, a few years ago, we had the South Atlantic League All-Star Game in Lexington, and a young pitcher from Hagerstown named Mariano Rivera Jr. was on the team, on one of the teams. And of course, he got lots of questions similar to the comments that you received. And he said he always just started the answer by saying, well, I'm not him. And it wasn't that he didn't appreciate everything that his father did, loved his father and loved his career, but he had to start off by saying, I'm not him. And so, you know, once you can, that was his way of making the separation. And of course, you want to do your own thing at the same time, saluting what your father left you.
Absolutely. And I, you know, he was my motivation. I mean, inside I said, you know, my dad was so good. I've got to try really hard to be the very best that I can be. I think that was kind of the motivator that made me want to succeed. And I did. I mean, I had a really good 35-year career and enjoyed all of it.
The ESPN in the early days, when you were there, it's interesting to combine the terms Wild West and Bristol, Connecticut, but that's kind of the concept that at least some of the guys in the business describe the early operation of ESPN. But tell me about it from the point of view of one of the on-air people. What was it like for you? How did the opportunity develop, and then what was it like while you were there?
I'll tell you how the opportunity came up. I was in Pittsburgh. And there were some changes happening at my station. They were bringing in the retired Pittsburgh Steeler, Rocky Blyer, and putting him on the air. And I don't know, I wasn't too happy about it. So I was sitting in the office one day and kidding around with the guys, and they had ESPN on the TV. And I said, I bet I could get a job on ESPN. Yeah, right. How are you going to do that? So I picked up the phone and called them. And they said, well, what do you do? Do you do play-by-play or do you do studio work? And I said, I do studio work. Well, let's put you through to Bob Knott. He's in charge of SportsCenter. I get through to Bob Knott. I told him who I was. He said, send me a tape. We're looking to hire two people for SportsCenter. Mm-hmm. So my dad had once told me, in this business and anything in life, luck and timing can be a big factor or big factors. And that's how that happened. And they liked my tape. They flew me up and interviewed me and hired me. And that was in 1981. There were no teleprompters. They were in the closet and they were locked up. And the reason was Scotty Connell, who was head of it, who'd come from NBC. All the executives at that time were from NBC. We called it NBC North. Felt we were better if we were extemporaneous and people could see how we really didn't know our sports. So we worked without prompters up there the whole 6 years I was there. We never had a teleprompter. Yeah. So that was challenging. The assets weren't there. we were just running on a shoestring. That network at the beginning was losing millions and millions of dollars. It was owned by Getty Oil, who knew nothing about broadcasting. Mm-hmm. The saving grace was the NBC influence, and the executives who had come up from NBC knew exactly what they were doing. And we were able to, I mean, I did the America's Cup races from Newport when Ted Turner was skippering, and then when they, I mean, we did all these kind of offbeat things that, because we didn't have any baseball, we didn't have any, we were just getting college basketball while I was up there. Actually, college basketball was the only thing that ESPN had. No NFL, no baseball. And people often wonder, how do you fill the time? What are you going to put on the air? Australian rules football, mm-hmm. a sport that you may remember was on at the beginning. And it was, I mean, I worked with Chris Berman and Bob Lee. You know, we had Greg Gumbel. We had good people. And the funny thing was, I was a little bit older. I was, I guess, close to 30, late 20s. And Chris Berman was 22, 23, had never done TV, was hired right out of doing radio, very inexperienced. Bob Lee had come from New Jersey, hadn't done much of anything either. They were learning, and they were both really good. And I remember one time Chris came up to me and said, oh, I don't know, David. He said, you guys make so much more money than I do, and blah, blah, blah. And I said, Chris, you're young, you're starting. They brought me in from Pittsburgh. They brought so-and-so from Chicago. They paid us what, you know, our experience would dictate we get. You're going to get there. I don't know. It's funny. Well, he's made a lot more than I ever made. So that's how that turned out. I went back up there 10 years ago, and I visited with Chris and saw the studios for the first time and went to see the old studio where we had worked in SportsCenter. And it was great to see him and visit with him for a little bit. But he's a good friend. We get along really well.
Yeah, and you know, of course, everyone knows Chris Berman for the nicknames as he describes players in the highlights, and of course, maybe the most visible or most well-known ESPN personality over the course of ESPN's history. But there was a time when there were people in the executive suites, if there were suites, questioning his methods and wanting him to tone it down a little bit. It's hard to imagine that.
Keith, they brought a new executive producer in from the outside. And the first thing he did was tell Chris Berman to drop the nicknames. He didn't like it. It was unprofessional. And he was no longer allowed to use any nicknames. Chris immediately picked up the phone and called USA Today and told them. And then he just bombarded them every day, went in with fan letters and dumped them on the guy's desk. He said, see, they love the nicknames. I got to do the nicknames. He said, no nicknames. I did a SportsCenter show with Chris during all of this. And at the very head of the story, a show, he said, I'm Chris Berman, and I'm here with David Silky Sullivan. And I said, oh, God, here we go. So he fought him tooth and nail, but finally the guy gave in and said, okay, you can do the nicknames. I give in. But they did. They tried to change him.
You mentioned the other programming that was done at that time before some rights to major sports were acquired, and you mentioned the America's Cup, and that's the kind of thing that if you're thinking conventionally, you're not going to think, well, there's our sports audience. We'll do the sailing, the big race, the America's Cup. But people did catch on. It became a thing where people wanted to get behind the USA and root it on against the foreign competition. Tell me about the coverage of the America's Cup.
Yeah, the America's Cup was fantastic. Number one, I wasn't in Newport. I was in the studio. And they just chroma keyed behind me a dock from Newport, a shot of the dock. And they had a fan blowing to kind of like it looked like my hair was blowing in the wind a little bit. And, you know, I was just we were using the cameras from a station up in Newport. I don't know if they were from Boston or what station they were now, but we were using their aerial footage. And I was narrating it and as best I could. And you would have things happen like the wind died. Well, when the wind dies, they can't sail, obviously. So we threw it to the weekend before. It was a Georgia football game. I can't remember who they were playing. So it was a tape game. This is at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. The switchboard at ESPN lit up. People called, what are you doing? Why are you leaving the sailing? They told me they had no clue that anybody was watching. They didn't know. So they dumped out of the football game and came back to me. And I had to fill time and try to do things and throw it to feature stories or whatever to fill until the wind came back up. But in those days, I mean, ESPN was the only place that could have done that. I mean, no network is going to devote time to doing that type of a program or coverage. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it was kind of an – and then later on they sent me to Newport to go with Dennis Connor, and his crew had the, you know, one of the lead yachts in that race. And we did an hour documentary with him sailing on his boat and putting a wireless mic on him and the crew. And it came out, we had a really nice documentary on that. So yeah, those were things, the doors were opening opportunity to ESPN that they really didn't envision when they first started out.
And just to jump back in eras here just for a minute, but it's interesting that you brought up the lack of wind delay, the wind died delay. One of your dad's concerns when he first went to Cincinnati was that he would have to cover rain delays, which is obviously you don't have to worry about that very much in football and basketball. But and he was especially concerned because he was going to step in and broadcast with one of the great rain delay talkers in history, in Wade Hoyt, who had been with the Yankees back in the 20s and had all those stories and had been a Reds broadcaster for a long time and was a huge fan favorite.
Babe Ruth, the people, you know, Wade could talk about the people from that legendary time. Now, you know, one time I asked my dad, I said, what's the toughest sport to do? He said, baseball. And I said, really? He said, yes, because you have dead times where there's nothing happening. And then all of a sudden the runner gets on first, and then there's a hit and the runner advances. Now you've got a ball hit out into right. There's a fielder coming in to pick up the throw. The runner's coming around. He said, and it's just like that, real fast. Lots happening, and then stops. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of time to fill, and how to pace yourself. So he felt it was the most challenging of all sports, and told me that basketball was the easiest. There are only 10 players on the court.
And you can actually see faces and usually numbers, and it's right in front of you. So, yeah, there are challenges maybe that people wouldn't suspect are there. But, yeah, with baseball, the game can be moving along. A guy gets on first, and all of a sudden there are three or four throws to first, and it's everything's on you then.
You know exactly what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
I haven't done much baseball myself. He scared me away from it.
well, he was very well liked in Cincinnati for the all-too-brief time that he was there. But did you get a chance to talk with Wade Hoyt at all, or get to know him a little bit?
Yes, I did. Mm-hmm. He was a gentleman. He was wonderful. He maintained a friendship with my mother for years after my dad had passed away. He would come down almost every year. He was retired, but he would come down and stay at the Campbell House, and he and his wife would take my mother out to dinner and things like that. He kept a good relationship with our family. He sent me a letter when I graduated from high school, a personal letter congratulating me on that accomplishment. I still got that. He was an artist. I don't know if you know Wade Hoyt was a very good artist.
Did not know that.
And yes, and that was his passion. And he gave me a sketch he did out the hotel window in Philadelphia when we were on that trip with the Reds. Mm-hmm. 1964, that I have it right over here in my office on the wall. So yeah, he was wonderful to my father, helped him, wanted to make sure that, you know, he wanted my dad to be the one working with him. He had chosen him or helped choose him. So they had a great relationship. I was very, very fond of Wade.
Yeah, I still have a couple of old Reds scorecards from Crosley Field, and across the top of the scorecard it would have the plug for the radio network with Wade Hoyt and Claude Sullivan, and they made quite a team. And actually, that was a pretty good adjustment for your dad. He had been the primary broadcaster. He was the primary voice on his broadcast, and to step in and to work with somebody of Wade Hoyt's stature and make it all work, that's not as easy as you might think.
No, it wouldn't be, but, you know, my dad liked the challenge, and he loved the Reds. He grew up a Cincinnati Reds fan. His dad took him to games way back, whatever, you know, in the 30s and 40s. So he had Cincinnati Reds in him. He loved that ball club and had followed him for years as a kid. So, yeah, it was a dream come true for him. Mm-hmm. I've said many times he only lived to be 42 years old, but, boy, he crammed so much into those 42 years and accomplished so much. Traveled the world, went to Russia, did all those things. He was an incredible guy.
Yeah, he really did. Really did have an amazing life. And let me mention the book again, Voice of the Wildcats, Claude Sullivan and the Rise of Modern Sportscasting, written by David's brother, Alan Sullivan, along with Joe Cox. And we've been talking about some of the stories and topics introduced in that book. I wanted to get back to the ESPN days. We talked a little bit about the America's Cup coverage, but another event that you were associated with during your time at ESPN was the 1984 Olympics. ESPN was, what, about 4 or 5 years old at that time? How were things progressing, and what was your role in the 84 Olympics?
I was called in April by the management. Scotty Connell is the president of ESPN in Bristol, the operation up there. And he said, we want you to go to Los Angeles and anchor our coverage of the Summer Olympics. I said, really? I was just dumbfounded, but I loved it. And our son was born in March. I come home thrilled to tell my wife, hey, I'm going to Los Angeles to cover the Olympics for ESPN. I'll be there for 25 days. She looked up at me and she said, no, you're not leaving me with this baby. You know, she came with me with the baby. And she was a flight attendant. My wife worked for US Airways. So she could fly out there, and then ESPN got me a suite so we'd have enough room for the baby and the crib and all that. The thing was, there was no studio. ESPN did not have a West Coast studio. So we had a sales department out there and office building floor, and they converted one of the offices into a makeshift studio and put an anchor desk in it. And I mean, it looked like we were in a studio, but we were just the producer and people behind the scenes were working out of a closet. I'm telling you, ESPN at the beginning was not fancy. It was by the seat of your pants. It was great. I loved that, and it was a great opportunity for me. And, of course, I would get, West Coast. I'd get a call at 7 a.m. every morning from Bristol. There's what we want you doing today. And I had been out the night before working until probably midnight.
Mm-hmm.
So it was hard work, and I think about day 23, the producer, Bernard Stewart, came to me, and he said, listen, you're exhausted. I want you to take tonight off. We're going to do a segment. You can tape it, and here's two tickets to a Diana Ross concert.
Wow.
At the Hollywood Bowl for you and your wife. I said, oh, my God. She'll be like that. So it was great. I tell you, that experience was one I'll never forget.
And, yeah, just covering an Olympics and having a prominent role like that as well. And are there any particular events that maybe presented the biggest challenge for you as the host or as you prepared for those broadcasts?
Well, you got to remember now, we didn't have the rights to the Olympics.
Mm-hmm.
We were going to events, and I was interviewing the people after they had competed, the athletes, about that event, and then we would go back to the studio and put together a packaged report.
Right. Like, okay.
2 or 3 minutes. So those, and then we did feature stories. We went to the village and did all. I can't even remember all the features we did, but I would do a couple of features every day. Behind the scenes, colorful things, and plus then covered the events. And we just had to be selective and pick out what we thought was the premier event of that night. And maybe Greg Louganis, the diver, he was the big one, big star in those games. So it was just crazy, really.
And in doing a story, say, about a Greg Louganis, people know who he is. They know the event that he competes in. But that's different than being able to conduct a good interview with him and bringing out the things you want to bring out in a feature. Did you have to prepare on the fly, or was that something you'd been able to do a little bit in advance before you went out there?
No, you can't do those things on the fly. You know that, Keith.
Yeah.
They told me in April, so I had, not that long. If I was going to be broadcasting the Olympics, I would have had a year or two to prepare, to learn everything you need to know. But to do what I did, I think I had a couple of months before I went out there to get that kind of material. And we had a team. There weren't many of us. It was a producer, Bernard Stewart, myself, There was an associate producer and a cameraman and an editor. So five of us put this thing together. I tell you, it was funny. ESPN worked on a very, in those days, very skeleton-type crews. Mm-hmm. And ABC was buying ESPN. This was right before I left, and I think it was 1986 or late 85. They bought it. Well, they sent a busload of vice presidents up to Bristol to see our operation. And I was doing that Sports Center that night, and I walked off the set, and these guys walked over to me in their suits and ties and said, "How the hell do you guys do this?" We don't understand it. You've got like eight people, and we have 50 or 100 to do a show. How do you do this? And we said, we just have learned how to do this without any too much help. You know, I doing Sports Center, this just came to mind, Keith, is a little in that vein. But when you're doing, in those days when you did Sports Center, and I did a lot of 11 o'clocks, and one that we aired live at 2:30 in the morning, I did that one because that's West Coast. That was the L.A. show, basically.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But on the 11 o'clock, games are ending just before you go on the air. Some are ending while you're on the air, so you've watched the games as much as you can. But they give you a lineup about 7:30, and I've got 18 different highlights I'm doing. Chris Berman has what he's going to do, so. But you get up there and you haven't seen any play-by-play sheets. Some of the games you have not seen. And they're handing you the script sheets as you're on the air live. And you've never seen the highlight before. It's the first time you've ever seen it. So the way it was done was it had columns. On the left column was called situation, like third quarter, 4:15 left. In the middle was what description of the play. And on the right-hand side was the result, which would say what the score was after that play was concluded. So you had lived off that sheet and watched the monitor. Well, that's fine if you've seen it ahead of time, but if you had never seen it and they hand it to you while you're live on the air, it was just flying by the seat of your pants.
Oh, yeah.
And my biggest challenge in that regard was hockey. I've never been a big hockey fan. I never was a fan of the sport. Well, Scotty Connell, the head of ESPN, was a huge hockey fan. And he played senior league hockey. He was in his 50s. He put out a memo that said, if anybody on SportsCenter ever mispronounces a hockey player's name, you will be terminated immediately.
Whoa.
I thought, oh, no. Guys knew that was not my strong sport. So I got the hockey guide and went through all the pronunciations, went over them all the time, and all the producers that when I had a hockey play-by-play to do would phonetically spell any name they thought I may not know that well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So.
Yeah. Yeah, living on the edge with that, because between the French Canadians and the Eastern Europeans, there are a lot of challenging names in hockey.
There certainly are, and I'll tell you, there are many highlights if you go back and look at old shows where I never said the name.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
The Islanders come from behind, they score the goal with 50, blah, 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 and you never said the name of the player.
Right, so, right. You can work around that sometimes and get away with it.
Yeah, sometimes it works.
I wanted to ask you about your days in Louisville with WDRB. You called the University of Louisville games on television, and I wanted to ask you about relationships with coaches. Howard Schnellenberger was the Louisville coach through at least part of your time there in Louisville. What was he like to work with?
I'll tell you the story about me and Howard Schnellenberger. I had just been hired at WDRB. WDRB had no newscast, no sport, nothing. And they were bidding on the Louisville games. And the story I was told that Bill Olson, the athletic director, asked John Dorkin, the late GM of WDRB, well, who's going to do the games? Who's your guy? He said, well, we're bringing this guy in, David Sullivan, who's been at ESPN. He's going to do sports. And he said, well, let me see a tape. He called him back and he said, if you can hire him, you'll get the games. So I went in there with them in my corner, people at the university like me. And very early on, Mr. Dorkin said, David, Coach Schnellenberger just called. He wants to meet the play-by-play man. And I said, okay. He said, so I want you to drive over there this afternoon and go in and meet with Coach Schnellenberger. I walked into his office. Now, anybody that knows Snellenberger, he's got a pipe in his mouth, very gruff, very intimidating person. He has all his memorabilia in his office. It's very intimidating to go in there. I just walked in, and he said, hi, and I said, Coach, nice to meet you. We have something in common. What? What do we have in common? I said, I played football at the University of Kentucky. Why? You did? Who'd you play for? I said, I played under Charlie Bradshaw. He got up out of his chair, stood up to shake my hand. He said, son, anybody who could have played for that man is okay in my book. And I had a beautiful relationship with him, working relationship. Never had any problems with Howard at all. He was very media conscious. He liked the media and liked putting on his hat of being the big mean football coach too. Yeah. He was good at that. And I got along well at the time with Denny Crum. They were all really good to me over there. And when I first went there, I said to the Bill Olson and so forth, I said, you know my background, right? I'm from Kentucky. And yeah. They said, we don't care. Just as long as you do a professional job on the games for us. So, yeah, I had a good time there, and I never had – you know, I did the Kentucky-Louisville football game in 96 when they renewed that series?
94, I believe it was.
94. We did that game back to Louisville, and it was so surreal for me to walk into the press box at Commonwealth Stadium, and I'm doing the Louisville game, you know, for Louisville. And I'll tell you something else. When I did sports in Louisville on DRB, the weeknight sports. First, when I first started, I got a phone call from a viewer after the show. They said, listen, pal, you're giving Louisville more time than they're giving Kentucky on your sports cast. And this happens all the time in this town. I'm getting sick of it. I said, do you know who I am, where I'm from? No, I don't. I said, well, I was Claude Sullivan's son. He said, what? I said, yeah. I played football at Kentucky. So there's nobody going to slight UK, believe me. But I have to cover both of them. It's just, you know, the way it is in this town. So that died down. I never had too much more of that.
Yeah, the guys working in Louisville, of course, the Indiana fans will call, too, if you don't devote enough time to them. So you've got a real triangle there you have to take care of.
It really is. You're right. The IU fans also can be on you really badly.
Well, just looking back over the career, are there one or two individuals that come to mind as maybe the most interesting, the most memorable sports figures that you met or interacted with during your time in broadcasting?
You know, Keith, I got to meet so many different players and be around them. To pick one out is kind of hard, but the one that to me was the classiest act was Jack Nicklaus. And in 1977, I was in Atlanta, and I was sent to cover the Masters. And boy, was that a peach of an assignment
sure.
to get. And I went over there, and I had a very demanding news director. He called me. This was during the first round. He called and said, all right, I want an interview on our 6 o'clock news tonight with Jack Nicklaus. I said, you can't get interviews like that at the Masters. You have to go to the interview tent, and the writers get them first, blah, blah, blah. They had all these rules. He said, let me put it to you this way. Either you get it, or I'll find another sportscaster.
Wow.
Yeah. So I said, God. So Nicklaus finishes his round. I got my camera, and you're not allowed to interview the golfers coming off the course. That is a strict rule at the Masters. Mm-hmm. They go to the interview tent with the writers first. I just saddled right up next to him. The camera was rolling, a microphone, and he looked at me and he said, you're not supposed to do this. I said, how was your round today? He paused and he gave me like a very short, quick answer. And he said, is that okay? I said, thank you, sir. And that was it. I was banned from Masters after that.
Yeah. Yeah, those rules are, they mean it, don't they? I mean, that's.
They put me in a roped off area after that. I couldn't go anywhere near the golf.
But on the other hand, your news director had his comment from Jack Nicklaus on the 6 o'clock newscast, right?
He did, exactly. Yeah. And that happened another time with Jack Nicklaus. Not that extreme, but the Atlanta Classic was being played, and I was covering that, and the news director had a thing with Jack Nicklaus. He'd wanted him on our air all the time. So it was a practice round, and it was a practice round. But nonetheless, he had teed off. And he went to the next green. He's waiting. I asked him for an interview. He said, I can't do an interview on the course. I said, I understand. I just had to ask you, understand that. And he said, sure, I do. You're doing your job. So I'm standing in the gallery behind the next tee, and there's a delay. And, I mean, I'm 10, 12 people back. And I look up, and he's looking for me. He's looking around the crowd, and he sees me, and he gives me a finger to come over. And he did an interview with me.
Right.
So he was just, I think those two experiences for me were special. For a man of his stature and success, you know, to do that for a young guy that, you know, was just kind of bothering him on the golf course when he shouldn't have been.
Well, I wanted to wrap up with this. We had talked a little bit on the subject of sailing with the America's Cup coverage, but there was a story in the book that Alan and Joe Cox related about your own personal sailboat and how it got its name and some of the things that you learned from your father that that fit into that name. Tell me about the name of your own personal sailboat.
My wife and I decided when we were in Pittsburgh, we wanted to get a little sailboat. There was a little lake north of Pittsburgh, Lake Arthur. And we went up there and we found this little one that you put on a trailer. I mean, it was like 15 feet long or whatever. And so we bought it. And my wife said, what are we going to call this? I looked at her and I said, we're going to call this Claude's Advice. She said, really? Why is that? I said, well, my dad always said, you know, if you want to do something, go do it and do it the best you can. And that's kind of how I feel. Plus, he had a boat when I was growing up, and I just felt like that would be a good name. So we had three sailboats, Claude's Advice 1, 2, and 3.
Well, that's a really nice tribute to him, and he did have his ways of doing things that he communicated to you and Alan and advised you as best he could, and obviously a lot of that has stuck. You both pursued diverse careers and have been very successful. It's been a pleasure to get to know both of you. And, David, I really appreciate the time today. Lots of great stories and some wonderful experiences in your broadcasting career, and sure do appreciate you sharing them with us today.
Keith, it was my pleasure. I really enjoyed it. I hope to see you soon when I get back to Lexington.
That sounds great, and I guess that'll be you hope in the next few months then, right?
In the spring. We're looking at March. End of March, yeah. Our son's there, and his wife, and we want to be near the family, and we both miss Kentucky, so it's a good plan.
Well, thanks again for the time today, and I hope we'll talk again soon.
I hope so. Thank you, Keith.
You've been listening to The Sports Page with Keith Elkins, an exclusive podcast from 91.3 WUKY, produced by Alan Lytle. Our theme music is Peanut Butter and Jam by Illogical Bit, available at soundcloud.com/illogicalbit. Subscribe to The Sports Page through Google Play or at our website, wuky.org.